News.
Iran warns against efforts to issue an anti-Tehran resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors meeting. Nigerian authorities say the gunmen have released all 279 schoolgirls who were kidnapped from a school in the northwestern state of Zamfara. Also in the headlines, Myanmar's police fire stun grenades to disperse anti-coup protesters in the city of Yangon. Thanks for joining us. Iran warns against efforts to pass a resolution at the International Atomic Energy Agency on the 2015 nuclear deal, saying that such a move would be counterproductive. The Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs slammed the European signatories for not complying with their commitments under the deal. Abbas Araghchi added that any anti-Iran resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors meeting would harm diplomatic efforts, especially after the recent inspection deal between Tehran and the UN agency. He also reiterated that Iran would only resume its full compliance with the nuclear deal when illegal sanctions against the country are lifted.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's 35-nation Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting with reports that Britain, France and Germany are circulating a draft resolution to criticize Iran for restricting agency access. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi reached a temporary bilateral understanding with Iran over a week ago, allowing the agency to continue verification work in the country for up to 90 days. Grossi said the understanding was meant to provide a window of opportunity for political talks to get underway amid attempts to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. The possibility of a board resolution, however, is further complicating the situation. Grossi appealed for constructive discussions that would preserve the work of the agency.
The inspection work of the IAEA must be preserved. The inspection work of the IAEA should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip.
Iran has warned of countermeasures if the board passes the resolution and says it's cooperating with the agency over questions about the presence of uranium particles at two undeclared sites. Grossi reiterated the IAEA would remain impartial, avoid judging intentions or issuing condemnations.
The work and the trust must always exist. And when we have doubts, we ask questions. We are not condemning anybody.
It's still unclear if the board will adopt the Western-backed resolution, but Russia has already made it clear it will oppose it. In a note to other board members, Russia warned the adoption of the resolution would hugely complicate efforts to revive the nuclear deal and undermine normal cooperation between Iran and the agency. I'm Homa Lizgi in Vienna.
The U.S. has once again expressed readiness to hold talks with Iran about how to salvage the 2015 nuclear deal after Tehran ruled out any informal meeting with Washington.
We are willing to meet with the Iranians in the context of the P5 plus one with the invitation from the EU. That offer of ours is on the table. If there are other ideas for ways in which we can engage in this principled, clear-eyed diplomacy together with our closest allies and partners, in coordination with our closest allies and partners, we're, again, not dogmatic about the form. What we are dogmatic about is the fact.
Ned Price stressed that the U.S. regards dialogue as the only path forward. The administration of President Joe Biden has expressed willingness to hold talks with Iran during an EU-proposed informal meeting of the signatories to the nuclear deal. This is what Iranian officials have repeatedly rejected any talks with Washington before it lifts all sanctions. Washington and Tehran remain locked in a standoff over reviving the accord, with both asking the other to act first. Journalist and commentator Walter Smolarek says the Biden administration's policy is a continuation of his predecessor's hardline stance toward Iran.
Primarily what we're seeing here is continuity between the Trump administration's policy of maximum pressure on Iran, so-called maximum pressure, this terrible euphemism for suffocating sanctions, constant aggression. That's more or less what Biden's position is as well. I mean, the airstrikes carried out against Syria, which Biden said were supposed to be a quote-unquote warning to Iran. I mean, the extremely belligerent negotiating posture taken by the Biden administration so far when it comes to the JCPOA, it indicates that his administration is not actually interested in diplomacy. What they're interested in, I think, is while they may have a strategic focus on China, they do fundamentally still desire regime change in Iran, or at the very least, they want Iran to essentially surrender their right to conduct an independent foreign policy.
Iran has called for an end to the sales of weapons used to kill innocent people in Yemen. Iran's permanent representative to the UN office in Geneva also demanded an end to the blockade on Yemen and military intervention there. Ismail Baghaei Hamaneh said action should be taken to facilitate the dispatch of aid to Yemenis. The country has been devastated by a Saudi-led war that began 6 years ago. On Monday, the UN warned of a, quote, death sentence for Yemen, as a donor conference yielded only less than half the funds needed to prevent a devastating famine. The UN has already warned that some 16 million Yemenis will go hungry this year. The United Nations investigator in the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi slams the U.S. for not taking action against the Saudi crown prince over the case.
That, to me, is an extremely dangerous move on the part of the USA. If what they want to do, which, you know, what President Biden has announced during this campaign, to protect freedom of the press and to really announce a new era in terms of human rights-based policy, then to refuse to hold to account, to sanction the man who is ultimately responsible for killing Jamal Khashoggi, that to me is extremely worrisome.
Agnes Callamard reiterated her earlier call for sanctions on bin Salman's assets and international engagements. On Friday, the U.S. slapped sanctions on some members of the Saudi Royal Guard over the 2018 murder. But bin Salman, who is their commander, was spared. The White House now says that they do not typically sanction leaders of governments with which the U.S. has diplomatic relations, although Washington reserves the right to sanction the Saudi prince. Political commentator Bijan Tavassoli says the U.S. refusal to sanction the Saudi crown prince over Khashoggi killing is because of Washington's own interests in the region.
I think that Washington knows very well that Saudi Arabia, it's not an independent nation at all. It's Washington's military base in the region, and they want to keep it that way. The reason they were threatening Mohammed bin Salman was only because he was seen as being too close to former President Trump. And what they're trying to do, the team around Joe Biden, they're trying to pressure him to pay off the Democrat lobbyists as well. They're not really trying for any change in Saudi Arabia. If they were doing that, then they would have to immediately sanction the entire Saudi royal family for the gross human rights violations they have committed over the last decades.
Nigerian authorities say that all 279 schoolgirls kidnapped in the northern state of Zamfara have been freed. Zamfara's governor says the girls have arrived in the government's house and are in good health. They were abducted by armed men from a boarding school on Friday. It was the third mass kidnapping of school children in Nigeria in less than 3 months. Armed groups have stepped up attacks in recent years, kidnapping for ransom, raping, and pillaging. The attacks have continued despite a 2019 peace deal with the groups. The latest abductions have put pressure on President Muhammadu Buhari as he is facing criticism over the security situation in Nigeria. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Nigeria, Danjuma Abdullahi, says negotiations are underway for the release of other children who were abducted in Nigeria.
279 girls are now in the custody of the Western Zamfara, Nigerian Zamfara state government, and are waiting to be reunited with their parents after being released by the bandits. There are 38 more girls that are yet to be accounted for, and the state officials are asking for a little bit more time to provide details of the remaining 38. All in all, 317 girls were abducted from a secondary school in Jangebe in Zamfara State, and 279 have now been safely released and in the custody of the government. Nigerian government has always maintained a position, and that position is that it is not paying ransom for any kidnapped victim. You will recall that it has happened in the northeast, in Dapchi, in Chibok, in Gagara, and now Jangebe. Many students, children, have been abducted. But the position of the government in all these instances is that it has not paid money for these children to be released.
Myanmar police have fired stun grenades to disperse anti-coup protesters in the main city of Yangon. The protesters chanted slogans against military rule from behind barricades set up in different parts of the city. Many of them wore hats or hard hats and held makeshift shields to protect themselves. Myanmar has been rocked by protests following a military coup that toppled the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, on February the 1st. At least 21 protesters have been killed since then. On Monday, Suu Kyi appeared in court via video link and faced two more criminal charges. Suu Kyi and much of her party's members have been in custody since the coup. The military had alleged fraud in November's elections that Suu Kyi's party won. Two United Nations rights experts have called for an international inquiry into the last year of poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny.
Mrs. Khan and I pursued an investigation over several months into the poisoning and attempted killing of Mr. Navalny. And the focus of our investigation was really to identify and determine the extent of state responsibilities for this attempted killing. We believe that an international investigation should be carried out as a matter of urgency in order to establish the fact and clarify all the circumstances concerning Mr. Navalny's poisoning.
The UN top expert on freedom of expression repeated accusations that Russia was behind Navalny's poisoning. That's a charge that Moscow has strongly denied. She also called for the immediate release of the Kremlin critic from jail. Navalny has been given 2.5 years in prison for violating the terms of an earlier suspended sentence. He was poisoned with a Novichok nerve agent in August 2020. The British Chancellor will announce the country's annual budget for the year ahead. Wednesday's announcement will be Rishi Sunak's second since the pandemic began and comes after a tumultuous year that saw sharp economic decline and rising redundancies across the UK. Saipur Azhar reports.
Among other things, the past year felt like a long one, featuring several announcements from British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, from massive spending to protect jobs.
Today we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help.
To the so-called Eat Out to Help Out scheme, and to what's known as the stamp duty holiday to help homebuyers. Since he was unexpectedly made Chancellor in February last year, Mr. Sunak has only made one formal fiscal statement. But on the 3rd of March, the young Chancellor will unveil his very difficult second budget, originally expected November last year, but postponed because of the uncertainty created by the raging pandemic and the possibility of a no-deal Brexit. But has that fog of uncertainty cleared now that they have a Brexit deal?
The biggest trade deal yet.
And the vaccination program is at full blast. Not exactly. The pandemic is still very much here, meaning serious restrictions will remain in place till at least midsummer. So given that lingering uncertainty, what does the UK public anticipate from Mr. Sunak's announcement? One expectation is an extension to the £20 a week increase in the government handout to the poor, benefiting some 6 million families due to end in March.
A lot of people I know who actually sort of, that is all they're earning at the moment. It's literally their less than £400 a month. Yeah, it's definitely, it's vital for them.
People are on it for a reason, you know. I know a nurse who's working 5 days a week and still has to be on universal credit.
There will probably also be an extension of the furlough scheme due to end in April. The UK's jobless rate rose to over 5% in the 3 months to December, leaving unemployment at 1.7 million.
It's hard to think that you're going to be able to find a lot of jobs for people right now, but they're coming back at some point, hopefully. But in the meantime, I mean, people have to get by somehow. People need money to buy food. People need money to just survive.
There are lots of people all over the country who don't have any income or have significantly reduced income because of the pandemic and the crisis.
Also expected, an extension of the various tax breaks help to educate children whose schooling has been so badly disrupted, or for the health service to cope with its long backlog of non-COVID waiting lists. And then there's the question of tax rises. The Chancellor has dropped many hints that tax rises are inevitable. Hikes in corporation tax, capital gains tax, carbon pollution taxes, and a new online sales levy are all under consideration.
Economists are unanimously warning the Chancellor to hold off imposing any new tax hikes, saying they will merely damage the economy. But will he heed that advice? And how will it impact the lives of millions of people around the country if he chooses to ignore it? Saeed Puriza, London.
Welcome back. Brazil has recorded nearly 36,000 new coronavirus cases, pushing its infection tally to over 10.5 million. Health officials also logged approximately 800 new fatalities, raising the overall death toll to nearly 256,000. Brazil remains the world's second worst hit country by the pandemic in terms of deaths. Elsewhere in the Americas, the Mexican Health Ministry registered 2,300 new infections. The country has reported nearly 2.1 million cases and over 186,000 deaths. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has warned that it is unlikely that the pandemic will be eliminated by the end of 2021.
I think it will be very premature and I think unrealistic to think that we're going to finish with this virus by the end of the year. But I think what we can, if we're smart, finish with is the hospitalizations and the deaths and the tragedy associated with this pandemic.
Ryan added the WHO's focus is on keeping virus transmissions low, preventing the emergence of variants, as well as reducing the number of sick people. The WHO Director General also expressed concern about the rise in new cases in Europe, the Americas, Southeast Asia, and the Eastern Mediterranean. Meanwhile, the U.S. remains the world's worst hit country by the pandemic in terms of both cases and deaths. American officials have so far recorded over 514,000 deaths out of some 28.7 million cases. Colin Campbell in Washington says the number of Americans vaccinated pales in comparison with those who need the vaccine.
Well, that number is still undetermined. There's still tens of millions of people that have been vaccinated so far, and they're still looking at ways to distribute that throughout the public this week. So that number will continue to climb, but it still pales in comparison to the number of people that need the vaccine because of the states that still have rates that are climbing daily, even though many states have plateaued. The number of their plateau is still higher than the number that was happening before the surge over the holidays, which happened late last year. So we still have hundreds of thousands of people that are still waiting for the vaccine, states that are still battling the COVID-19 virus, that are still overwhelmed, and the number of people that still need it still is in the millions of people. So again, the remedy is not quite there, and the need is great here in the U.S.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Whoa, 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 whoa. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of this series. In continuation of discussing Imam Khomeini's ethical virtues, we are going to touch upon his detachment to the worldly and material issues. Of course, this does not mean the Imam led a life of a hermit in seclusion from the society. Rather, it means that he tried his best to form the strongest bond with God and the spiritual world while living among people and helping them in their problems. One of the unique characteristics of Islam is the approach towards this world. The Islamic view to the world is focused on refraining from the worship of God on the one hand and prohibition of seclusion and hermitage on the other. Islam is quite different from the religions that preach seclusion from society and going to a temple far from the social responsibilities. It emphasizes that the faithful are duty-bound to heed material issues while detaching themselves from its trappings. In other words, Islam warns against going to extremes on both sides. According to the teachings of Islam, God calls on the faithful to enjoy the bounties of this world as they are not obstacles on the way of spiritual perfection if they are used in the correct way. In the first years of Islam, a few Muslims had misunderstood Islam and tried to live like Sufis, away from the worldly affairs. One of them had left his family and stayed in a mosque to spend his time in worship. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, strongly castigated his behavior, saying, "Do you know that God has not sent me for hermitage? My religion is the religion of innate nature. I perform prayer, fast, and I associate with my wife. Anyone who follows my religion should accept my practice. Marriage and association between wife and husband is among my practices." The Noble Quran also recommends the faithful to enjoy halal bounties. In Ayah 168 of Surah Baqarah, we read, "O mankind, eat of what is lawful and pure in the earth, and do not follow in Satan's steps. Indeed, he is your manifest enemy." Contrary to seclusion from the world, Islam has called on its followers to enjoy the worldly bounties while keeping aloof their harmful aspect. Islamic texts and the Noble Quran use the word zuhd in this regard. Zuhd means paying attention to this world's affairs in a way that they do not prevent us from moving in the path of perfection and sublimity. Hermits and most of the nuns and monks in the West try to detach themselves from material world in a way that they do not participate in people's affairs and are apart from their problems. But Islam stresses that the path of perfection and proximity to God passes through social responsibilities and communion with people. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was among the persons who enjoyed the virtue of zuhd at a very high level. Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani says, when the Imam preached ethics, he would censure seeking the world and worshipping the world. Sometimes after the end of the class, one would dislike the world to the extent that it would look as a broken pottery that nobody pays attention to it. Hujjat al-Islam Zainul Abedin Bakui also recounts this. After the demise of late Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi, the seminaries were closed for 40 days. On the first day of the classes, Imam Khomeini advised the students not to grieve on their sustenance. When the students asked him what to do after the demise of the great source of emulation, the Imam answered, "You should have high ambition so that the world is not worth a farthing in your eyes." Dear listeners, although on the one hand Imam Khomeini would prevent the students of seminaries and ulema from attaching to the world, on the other hand, he would seriously warn them not to sacrifice their hereafter for the world of others. Late Ayatollah Bani Fazl said, "In the beginning of the sacred Islamic uprising, when Imam Khomeini had become known as the source of emulation, he told his family members, 'If there is a chairmanship and world, it is not for you. If you are wise, do not spend from your religion for my world. Stay firm and resolute in your religion.'"
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavitat Wade. The twists and turns of the Iran nuclear file continues unabated. In the latest, the Europeans have pushed an IAEA Iran resolution, anti-Iran resolution, despite warnings by Russia and Tehran. This comes from the same countries who were supposed to actually adhere to their commitments when the U.S. pulled out of the Iran 2015 nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. In this edition of the debate, we will look at whether the Europeans and the U.S. are now in one camp and whether E3 has changed its tune in this way when it comes to Iran. First, let's find out what is actually going on. From Vienna, our correspondent Homa Lesky joins us. Well, Homa, since the last time we spoke, we have had France actually make a statement regarding how it's going to still pursue some kind of path to resolve this. Is that representative of what the E3 or the EU stance is at this point? And, of course, any other developments that may have occurred since then?
Yes, Kava, as you say, the IAEA Board of Governors session has begun. It convened today, and it will be ongoing in the next few days. And just as it started, news came out that these three Europe signatories to the nuclear deal, the JCPOA, have circulated a draft resolution to the other board members. And that resolution, which has been backed by the United States, criticizes Iran on a number of issues, including Iran's decision to restrict its cooperation with the IAEA, to restrict the agency's access, and to suspend the implementation of the additional protocol, and also concerning some questions that the agency has raised about Iran and the uranium particles found in undeclared sites in Iran. And this criticism and this resolution is coming at a very critical time. And this is why the Russian ambassador here, also in a paper that was distributed, or a note that was given to members of the IAEA, said that Moscow would oppose this resolution, would not vote for it, and believes that at this time it will just complicate the process for efforts to revive the JCPOA, and it will, in the words of the Russian ambassador, also undermine the normal cooperation that exists between Iran and the agency. When Mr. Grossi was asked about this today in the press conference, he said that the IAEA should remain impartial and should not give any political opinion, but he did make it clear that what he wants in any political arrangement or any negotiations is for the agency to be able to continue its work in Iran. It will be a big blow to the current level of ties if the JCPOA does indeed collapse. And now, as you say there, the Europeans on the one hand saying that they are serious about reviving the deal, on the other hand making this extra pressure on Iran and putting this extra pressure on Iran at the IAEA headquarters here at the Board of Governors session, because if this resolution is passed, Iran has said there will be consequences, there will be countermeasures. Will Iran scrap its current temporary technical understanding that it's reached with the agency? What will those countermeasures be? Iran hasn't been very specific about them, but it is definitely going to influence the situation and impact the process of this political negotiation that's not very, at the moment, going anywhere.
When is that going to actually be voted on or looked at, this resolution? I believe it's Friday, if I'm correct.
Well, it depends, because there are a number of issues on the agenda at the Board of Governors session. Iran is not the first issue on the agenda. Today, the press conference of Director General Grossi, which usually it's probably tomorrow, but as you say, either Thursday, Friday, it depends on the progress that these discussions take. At that level, at that time, when the Iran issue does come up, then we'll hear more also from the Iranian ambassador here. He probably will deliver his own statement, and we'll see if actually there is an agreement, if actually members decide to vote on the resolution, and if indeed they do vote, if they will be able to adopt it.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Homolesky there from Vienna. All right, let's bring in journalist and author Daniel Lazar from New York. Daniel Lazar, welcome. You know, this move by France, Germany, and the UK pressing ahead with a U.S.-backed plan for a resolution by the UN Nuclear Watchdogs Board criticizing Iran for curbing cooperation with the agency. Why do you think that they have taken this type of stance when the situation, as fragile as it is, could derail maybe any hopes for trying to solve this situation?
Well, I mean, all the parties, all sides, the U.S. and the Europeans, are very weak and irresolute at this moment. Biden is torn. He doesn't really know what he wants. His foreign policy team is in disarray. They're not sure if they want to go forward with the negotiations or halt them while they place additional demands on Iran. Apparently, the debate about that is still going on behind the scenes. The Europeans just want to repair relations with the U.S. after the Trump years and get everything back to normal, but that means trying to compromise with the U.S. and do its bidding, and that's not working either. I'm extremely pessimistic about the JCPOA negotiations. I don't think they'll succeed. I think the treaty is heading to defeat, to an early demise. And I think what we're seeing now is the process of collapse that is ongoing.
Okay, let me bring in George Samueli from Budapest. He's a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute. who joins us. George Samueli, welcome. Our guest there, Daniel Azar, saying that he's not optimistic at all, and he believes that this thing is really unraveling. At this point, we're seeing a move, in a sense, an anti-Iran move by the E3, although just in the past hour, we've had France come and say, as disappointed as they are going to look for some type of path to try to see if they can resolve this. Why do you think the E3 made this move at this point, George Samueli?
Well, for the Europeans, they are much more interested in maintaining their relations with the United States than they are in adhering to the JCPOA. I mean, they made an endless number of promises to Iran back when the JCPOA was being negotiated, that should the United States walk away, and that was always expected, should the United States walk away and restore sanctions, the E3 would go out of their way to alleviate the pain that Iran would suffer as a consequence. This never happened, despite all the promises that they would set up a financial mechanism to alleviate the pain of Iran. It never materialized. And this was back in the Trump years. So this had nothing to do with their feelings about Trump and trade or anything like that. So they never did anything about it. Now, again, you know, to them it's more important to keep in with Washington than it is to do anything for Iran. And so therefore, it's if, now that it's clear that the Biden administration isn't going to do anything very much to return to the JCPOA. I mean, they'll talk a good game. Yes, we're prepared to go back in as long as Iran returns to its side of the deal. Well, let's remember, Iran was not the one that walked away. Iran never violated the JCPOA. It was the United States that did so. So it is an absurdity for the United States to make any of these demands, that Iran somehow must make the first step. And the Europeans should know this. And instead, the Europeans are making these noises that, yes, Iran must return to the limits imposed by the JCPOA. Well, of course, it's an absurdity. And, you know, time and again, like as you mentioned about what Monsieur Macron has said, yeah, time and again, the Europeans flap their hands and say, yes, we definitely must go back to the JCPOA and we must do something, but nothing ever materializes. So I think as your previous guest pointed out, I think the JCPOA is a dead letter.
Okay, if we want to take a look at what France has said, Daniel Azar, you know, again, saying that it's disappointed with what Iran has done, but yet it's going to look for a way to try to see if we can solve this, which is, in a sense, what the E3 wants to also do. It almost makes one lead to concluding, in one sense, that perhaps we're looking at posturing, even though Iran has every right, by many accounts, to make its demand and make it clear, as it did just days ago when it said it would not participate in a European Union proposal to hold a meeting with the U.S. and the other parties of the deal. Do you think this is all about posturing right now?
Well, it's not posturing on Iran's account. I mean, I think that's really unfair to Iran, which is the aggrieved party in this case. I mean, it was the U.S. which unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, leaving Iran with very few options, especially since the Europeans refused to counter the U.S. walkout. And now Iran is doing what it feels it has to do. The U.S. is engaging in posturing, saying on one hand that it wants to rejoin the JCPOA, while on the other hand refusing to do so. And clearly, the name of the U.S. game is putting the blame on Iran if the negotiations fall through, as they likely will. So that's what U.S. posturing means. It means a phony attempt to show that it is loyal to the JCPOA while setting Iran up for a fall and trying to convince the world that Iran is responsible. This is extremely dangerous, and I think it's going to lead to some kind of military crisis in the Persian Gulf,
which is the last thing that anyone should want.
Well, before we get to that angle or to that issue, George Samioli, the IEA Director General, made a statement that the inspection work at the firm or the organization should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip. Now, given the fact that you have Britain, France, and Germany pressing ahead, and I mentioned this in the beginning of the program, with a U.S.-backed plan for a resolution by the U.N. Nuclear Board of Governors, a U.S.-backed plan, what does that U.S.-backed plan mean? Does it mean that the E3 came up with it, the U.S. backed it, or the U.S. came up with it, the E3 presented it, and went forward with it?
Well, I think it's the latter. I think the U.S. Drafted the plan and then laundered it through the Europeans, so it seems like a European plan. Look, it's not complicated. If the United States was really serious about returning to the JCPOA, it could easily make a goodwill gesture of lifting some of the sanctions. To say, okay, we're going to lift some of the sanctions. Let's now move on a step-by-step process of returning to the JCPOA. The United States hasn't done so. Instead, the Europeans and the Americans are now presenting a line of argument that somehow it's Iran's fault, it's Iran that isn't adhering to the JCPOA, and that we need to renegotiate that agreement so that, we'll return, the United States will return to the JCPOA, but in return, Iran will have to make concessions, both about its ballistic missiles program and about its regional influence. Well, Iran's not going to do it. Iran is not going to return to an agreement that is worse from Iran's point of view than the one that it signed in 2015, particularly when there's no guarantee that this agreement will be adhered to by the United States at all. I mean, let's remember, there's a reasonable chance that Donald Trump will be back in 2024, or another Republican will be elected in 2024, and then the United States will again withdraw from the JCPOA. So what's the incentive for Iran to return? Now, yes, sanctions are certainly painful, but Iran does have friends and allies who have done something to help out Iran economically, namely Russia and China, above all China. So for Iran now to make a decision, well, if we return to the JCPOA, we have to then give up our ballistic missiles program, and we have to give up our regional allies. Well, that's an existential issue for Iran. I mean, its ballistic missiles are vital for its defense, and its regional allies are vital for its defense. It's not going to give those things up in order to return to an agreement that it has no reasonable basis to believe the Americans will adhere to.
Okay, you talked about war, Daniel Lazar, as a possibility here if agreement obviously is not made or if this thing is not solved. Haven't the parties been down this path before they struck that deal, the JCPOA deal? I mean, you know, there was a lot of tension, and you had accusations flying around on Iran from, you name it. And of course, Israel had some hand in the way that it was demonizing Iran. But, you know, that path has been traveled. So don't you think that diplomacy here should prevail somehow, and for this deadlock to be solved before that path or that result comes about?
Of course it should be. There should be diplomacy should take hold. But the U.S. and its allies seem to be dead set against it. I mean, look, you're right. I mean, Iran is, I mean, a war is something that always is being predicted in the Persian Gulf. I've predicted five of the last two wars myself. So we can't be sure what the future holds. We don't know what the parties will do. Israel is engaging in some very serious sword rattling, but that just may be all for show, an attempt to throw Iran off balance. We can't be sure. But I do believe that if the JCPOA does fall through once and for all, that the gloves will be off and the chances of a military conflict will rise significantly. beyond that, we can't predict anything. But that itself seems clear enough. And you're right, that is all the reason, all the more reason to continue down the diplomatic path.
Do you think that that is where this is going to end up, George Samueli? And when our guest talks about military conflict, what type of military conflict between whom would that happen if something like this happens?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because remember, during the Trump years, there was a frequently cited prediction that there will be a military conflict between the United States and Iran. And it seemed like that was a possibility following the assassination of General Soleimani. However, if you recall, the Trump administration backed off. It allowed Iran to retaliate, lobbing missiles at U.S. forces, and the United States did not retaliate back, which is a first. I mean, the United States doesn't just let that go, you know, being attacked, its troops being attacked. It nonetheless let it go because it didn't want to get into a war with Iran. I have my doubts that there'll be a war with Iran. It's not a war that the United States is in any real position to win very easily. I mean, it can't invade Iran. Iran's just much too big and powerful a country to invade. It can lob missiles at Iran, but Iran can retaliate, and not even necessarily against the United States. I mean, it can retaliate in the Persian Gulf against Saudi Arabia, against the Gulf states. It can bring the entire the global oil industry to a standstill. This is not something that the United States wants to happen. Now, of course, things could spiral out of control. The Biden administration looks very weak and indecisive at the moment. No one really knows who exactly is running the show there. So it's a possibility. I don't necessarily think that a war with Iran is likely, and certainly not with Israel. Israel wants others to fight its wars for it. It doesn't like fighting countries that can fight back. I mean, it likes making these raids on Gaza, its raids in Lebanon, its raids in Syria. It has no intention of taking on a major power like Iran. So, Israel would quite like to provoke a conflict with between the United States and Iran, but it's not going to get involved in a direct war itself.
Okay. The elections in Iran is going to be coming up soon, Daniel Lazar. And, of course, there's some camps out there, maybe in the U.S. perhaps, that may think, why should the type of negotiations on this obviously very important issue be happening with the current government, and it should happen with the next Iranian government. Of course, Iran is not going to stand for that length of time to surpass. At this point, it is given that deadline, which it will cross out if this resolution at the Board of Governors is going to be passed. Is there a possibility that we're looking at the U.S. perhaps taking that stance along maybe with the E3, or is that not the case?
It's very hard to tell. I mean, I agree with George that the whole bunch of factors that work here and adding them up involves some very complicated arithmetic. The U.S., but I think the U.S. government is in disarray. Biden doesn't really know what he wants. But I think if the U.S. thinks we'll gain anything by putting the negotiations off for 3 or 4 months, I think it's sadly mistaken, because whatever new government comes into power in Iran, I think that the one conclusion it will draw from this whole sorry experience is that negotiations with the United States are really pointless, and there is no reason to go down that road again.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guest, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, and thank you, journalist and author Daniel Lazar from New York. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikova Tafwa, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: شارك الذي قد أقبل عليه الرزق، فإنه أخلق للغنى وأجدر بإقبال الحظ عليه.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "Be a sharer with him who has an abundant livelihood, because he is more probable to get more riches and likely to secure an increase of the share therein."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this concept about piety. Now, we had talked about in one of our sessions that taqwa, which is commonly translated as piety, has another angle about it, which is this consciousness or this awareness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, meaning that we are aware that Allah sees all, He hears all. Now, when we start to realize that Allah is ever-present, He sees everything, He hears everything, this in turn leads us towards piety. And piety in its various different forms. One of the forms of piety, of course, is to abstain from the world, abstain from the dunya, abstain from the materialistic world, these materialistic desires. Of course, if one is conscious and aware of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then the fake glamour and the pomp and the mirage of the world and materialistic things won't be attractive to a person. Rather, it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala which will attract a person's heart, mind, and soul. So Abdullah ibn Abil Hudayl reports, I saw Imam Ali wearing a razi shirt. This must have been a type of shirt in that time, which was such that if it stretched, it would reach the nail of his fingers, and if he let it loose, it could hardly reach the elbow. Umar ibn Abdul Aziz reports, among this ummah, we do not know anyone more pious than Ali after the Holy Prophet. And finally, Qubaysa ibn Jabir reports, I have not found anyone more pious than Ali ibn Abi Talib. Now, don't get me wrong, there's something that needs to be cleared up, and that is this fact that some people think, well, perhaps Imam Ali alayhi salam was so pious and he abstained from the world because he was poor. No, dear brothers and sisters, if you look a little bit closer into the history of Islam, into the history of Muslims, you will find that Imam Ali alayhi salam was considered one of the wealthiest, richest people of his time. And the piety and the beauty and the peak of this piousness of Imam Ali alayhi salam is in this, that despite being the wealthiest person of his time, he would give his wealth away to the poor and to the needy and to the oppressed, and he himself lived like the poor in order to help the people around him. A truly profound and beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
Amir al-Mu'minin